don't immediately jump to the, you know, prestige. Like, prestige doesn't matter anymore. Like, the big schools don't matter anymore.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, I'm joined by Amjad Massad. Amjad is the founder and CEO of Replit. Replit is a Y Combinator-backed online development environment that helps developers learn, build, collaborate, and host all in one place. They're on a mission to make programming more accessible. In this episode, Amjad shared why he believes that discovering great people is the key to great teams. He contrasts that with identifying great people, which is about credentials and resumes. We also talk about the state of developer tooling and how leaders can decide if they're investing the right amount. And now, here's my conversation with Amjad Massad. Amjad, thanks so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams. So what got you into building software originally?
I was lucky to get into it really early on. And the first time I interacted with the computer, I was 6 years old. That was 1993. My father brought in a computer. I don't actually remember the exact model, but I feel like it might have been an IBM and had DOS on it. And I sort of started peeking behind his back as he was trying to learn it and kind of struggling with it. And I remember, like, every night he was fascinated by it, but he really didn't at the time have the skills to be able to know how to operate it. And then I'd go in after he'd leave it, and I'll start kind of tinkering with it. And at first I learned a little bit of kind of DOS commands and how to create directories and delete directories and things like that, how to launch games and things like that. And then later on, I think I got my start in BASIC. Before BASIC, actually, there was a visual programming environment. We went to this computer show where I'm from in Jordan. There was, like, I'm not sure if it still happens. We had this yearly sort of computer sort of like big conference or show where you go and people like are showing the latest like computer technology. And there was CDs had just came out and we had a CD driver. And my father and I were just walking around and I saw this like collection of CDs in a box and it had like some like number of different softwares. I don't know what attracted me to it. It had like an accounting software and had a few other boring stuff.
Like what all 10-year-olds love, accounting software.
Right. But one thing that was really cool about it was it had this visual programming environment. And I remember booting it up and I immediately got it. Like I understood that there's these logic operators, that there's these different blocks that execute code on different events. And I sat down and the first thing I built was a game to teach my younger brother, who by the way currently works with me at Replit.
So your teaching worked.
Yeah, I taught him math. So I made a program where it gave you an equation and just hid one part of the equation and you had to guess it. So it could be a plus, like, you know, x plus 10 equals 19, and you had to guess that x was 9, and then I'll clap that x was 9, and then I'll clap. I'll have like some sound. That was really when it clicked, when like, yeah, you can, this is like an insanely powerful medium and like I can make a lot of things on it. And then I think fast forward, and when I really built my first large software that had users was when I was 15 years old and I built an application in Visual Basic. And I can dig into that if you'd like to hear, but I'll stop here.
So you were in computers early. You found that you liked them. So I built like a gas calculation program was my very first one. Similar story.
Oh, cool. Like for your parents?
I didn't even have a car. It was just like a thing. I think it was in the Kernighan and Ritchie C book, or I don't know where the idea. I was like, all right, we got multiple people. We got a distance. How do we split the trip cost?
Did you get users? Anyone to use it?
No, it's command line. I actually did. I had my friend. I made him go in and.
Yeah, that was like, that's like the most exciting and frightening thing is like when you get your first user ever, you might be scarred for life because you might have had an input that that accepts numbers, and then someone puts a character. and you're like, what the hell? What is this? What are you doing? This is not, you're not supposed to do that. And that's how software engineers become paranoid.
Absolutely. I think that's a very useful paranoid. Do y'all do a lot of user testing where as you're building new releases, you bring in users to try out Replit and see the new changes?
We've taken a little bit of a different approach. We try to have users as part of our design process. We have a large beta group that tests our programs, and we have different chat rooms with different groups of users. So we have a chat room with our developers, and we have a chat room with our teachers. So Replit serves developers and serves teachers and students. There's like a wide array of users and use cases. And so for every one of those, we kind of like get feedback early on. Sometimes I'll post a mock-up in the chat room and see what they think about it. Sometimes I'll hop on a multiplayer session with them. So for example, multiplayer is our like collaborative coding feature. So you can turn it on for any environment that Replit supports. And so that's been a, like sort of a boon for user testing, because like I can jump in and you know test some new feature we're building live with the users. Sometimes I see our developers like paste a sort of a live session on Discord. I'll just click just to kind of lurk and see how they're using it, how they're collaborating. We don't have a process per se. It's part of the DNA of the company. Users are part of the process, and we couldn't have gotten this far without this sort of some people call it participatory design.
Can you think of an example where you came with a design that you thought was great, and then the users came in, and now your design is much better?
In multiplayer, we've had a few design decisions at first that weren't that obvious, and we've had a month long closed beta that really fixed the product by a lot. So for example, we weren't convinced that chat is needed.
In multiplayer? Interesting.
In multiplayer, yeah. We're like, you know, people use Discord and Slack and they probably have an open separate window. And then when we saw users use it, they were chatting in the comments. They had a big comment block up on the file and they were chatting there. We're like, okay, that's obviously. So the best feedback you'd get is when people hack your product to do something it wasn't intended to do. This is the best feedback you'd get. Because, you know, it's kind of a cliche now in sort of tech that, you know, users don't know what they want. You know, the famous, you know, Ford saying, like, you know, if I had asked people what they wanted, they would say, you know, faster horses. They wouldn't have suggested a car. And it's a cliche because there's, like, truth to it, right? People are bad. And if you look at the literature in economics, there's this idea of like revealed preference versus professed preference, right? People say one thing and generally do a different thing under the circumstance. So people are bad at predicting their own behavior. So what you want to do is you want to see their behavior. So in our case, it's like, you know, we saw that behavior and that was like very sort of in your face, like, yes, we need to fix this. We need to add this.
People are building their own chat and comments. The thing about that Henry Ford quote that always gets me is like, but they told you they wanted speed. They wanted things faster. Like,
yes.
All right. I'm glad I talked to my users.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's, I think some people, especially in Silicon Valley, take it to the extreme of that quote to the extreme. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that they gave them data. Right, they gave them, and that's what you need to look for users for data. You're not looking for suggestions; you're more looking for data.
I run a startup. I'm a leader, and I feel like I'm failing constantly at lots of things, so that I can kind of not fail at one or two things. Sometimes I don't ship, and I think it's a lot of what you wrote about in perfectionism. How do you fight that urge?
I think perfectionism is masking a lot of different emotions underneath it. It's rarely that someone is truly a perfectionist. I think most of the time it is masking some negative emotions. I think most prominently is fear, sort of fear of being criticized. You don't want to ship and you hide under that perfectionism mantra because you're afraid of getting negative feedback. Another one is embarrassment. You kind of like, you don't want to ship something because you're a little bit embarrassed by it, right? And then there's that famous Reid Hoffman quote where if you've shipped something that you're not embarrassed by, you've shipped too late. And there's a lot of truth to that. And so you'd want to fix those underlying emotions. And I haven't looked at my post in a while, but I think I talk about sort of a kind of exposure therapy, right? So a lot of the way I fix my, and I think so the larger point here is like being a creator, being a founder, being an entrepreneur, the biggest bottleneck tend to be your own sort of emotions, your own mental state, your own psychology. And I use my blog as a sort of an outlet to do self-debugging in that sense. So when I wanted to debug perfectionism, I kind of try to break it down to its underlying components. And one of them I detected, and the biggest one I think is fear. And so the way I would treat that is by shipping a bunch of things. You know, there's been this trend where people have this 100 day of coding and every day they ship a website. I'm not sure if you've seen that.
I have, yeah. I've seen some people post about their websites.
Yeah, like you'd go and like they build 100 sites in 100 days. Like at the end, you've just kind of just annihilated that fear that you might have from shipping or embarrassment. So I would treat perfectionism that way. Now that is not to say that in some cases you might actually want to go the full way, right? You know, so we have this 80-20 rule. You can get 80% of the benefit with 20% of the work. Sometimes you actually have to go the full 100%. Sometimes like if you're entering a market where it's already kind of very advanced and you're building a product in that market, you might want to actually like try as much as possible to perfect it because people are going to have a certain set expectation. But for most of the time, maybe 80, 90% of the time, actually you're just creating something new and people are going to be fine if it's like a little bit janky and not polished.
What's something at Replit that you've shipped that you were just a little bit embarrassed about? You saw the 100% and you weren't there, but you knew the right move was to ship the 80%.
There's so many. I would say probably by the time this podcast is out, we're gonna have shipped it. So we've been working on a way to do graphics on Replit, and not just like web graphics, any type of graphics. Like you can write a Pygame application, you can write in Ray Tracer in Haskell, and it will render in the browser. And so it's a pretty ambitious project, and we've been doing sort of research and development for it for 3-4 months now, if not more. And we've had three different approaches to the technology, and all three sort of worked. And that's like the worst place you want to be at is that when you have three different approaches and all three sort of work, because you want to have some redundancy and then one of them works and it's great. But for us, all three had some suboptimal parts to them. We picked the one that we thought we would be able to polish as soon as possible and just ship it. And I told my team, we just have to ship. And I think in the beta, it might be a little bit janky, but I think, you know, once we get feedback and we address the need that exists out there, I think people will be already happy with it. So it's sort of already leaked that we're working on this, and I'm getting emails from people that like, hey, I want to be able to try it. I'll give them the link to the alpha, and they would still like put hours into it to make it work, although it's like very buggy. And so a lot of the times in your mind, you're like, no, I don't want to release this because it's buggy. And you need to think about it. And one of our recent hires, Sikhan, mentioned this to me the other day. It's like, we need to think about the delta that we're providing people, the delta in utility. The perfect product feature will, let's say, bring 80% increase in utility, whatever utility measure. But the sort of janky, slightly embarrassing feature is still going to be like 50%. Then you should ship it, right? And there's also like the law of diminishing returns. The more you try to perfect it, the less utility you're adding to your user. You know, ultimately you want to go back and fix and polish things, but you know, I think graphics, which will go out in a week or two, is probably going to be a little bit janky at first, but I think we're going to have to deal with it. If you want, I can give an example of a thing that we sort of fretted and tried to get as much as perfect as possible.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it. Was that because of the delta? You felt like it needed more perfection because the delta wasn't versus zeros or something else?
Yeah, so in this case, we're working on our sort of creation flow. When you create a new REPL right now, we dump you into this big languages page and you have to kind of look at all the languages and pick one. We are coming up with a sort of a better, you know, creation flow where you have the optionality to import from GitHub. You can name your REPL. You can, you know, do all this upfront work. It's kind of like creating a repo on GitHub. And this is going to be in the critical path for everyone using the product, right? This is, we'll have 100% exposure on our users. This is going to be in the path where people have the most muscle memory. So you can't iterate on that too much because people are going to be annoyed all the time, right? If you know, when something that I use often, say Twitter, changes a small thing, like I remember once they added moments instead of search, and I kept clicking on moments by mistake, and I was so annoyed for a while. And so anything that has to do with muscle memory and people have been used to it for a long time, you really want to try to be as careful as possible when you're changing it. You know, you contrast that with something you're creating that's new. When it's new, then people have tolerance for change and they understand it's new, it's going to go through some iterations.
If my alternative is figure out how to install PyGAM locally and get it to work with everything to be able to do any graphics, I'm probably more likely to put up with some bugs in an alpha version. I mean, yeah, that makes perfect sense. I think developer tooling mostly still sucks. What's going to change about our industry as that gets better?
You know, it's an interesting question to ponder. One of the highest leverage, most expensive jobs on the planet, we're seeing underinvestment in tooling in it. And it's an interesting maybe question for an economist to kind of do a study on. Like, why haven't companies invested in developer tooling? Like, for most companies, a hiring manager would get a new engineer, and they have choice between putting them to build tools for other engineers in the company or putting them on a product or a feature. They usually tend to go with the latter. They tend to put them on a product and feature. So it's interesting to ask a question like, why is that? And yeah, I've thought a little bit about that, and one of the reasons is the measurement problem. And so this has been discussed since the early days of software engineering, most famously in the sort of mythical Man Month, where they talk about what is the optimal measure for engineering productivity. They look at lines of code and they see that this is like really bad measure. But we don't really have a good measure, therefore it's something that's really hard to optimize, you know. So that's why I think the state of software engineering is sucks, and tools. So how it would get better? I think people are starting to wake up to the idea that investing in tools has an outsized effect. If you have a company with 10,000 engineers, and you have an engineer that could increase productivity by 0.1%, they've already created outsized returns, right, on your investment. So there is some evidence, and I think we're going to see more investment in this space.
If I'm listening and I'm an engineering manager and I have some ability to allocate those folks towards tooling versus features, what are some heuristics that I might use to make that right decision? Especially because I've got, you know, I've got a product manager, I've got someone looking for new features, hit revenue goals. How do I kind of thread that needle?
It's going to be more art than science. So I'll just say that up front, it's going to be some trial and error. I would say the first thing is sort of perk up your ears and listen to your engineers. Are they talking about, let's say you're building a web app, and are the engineers having to fiddle with Webpack and their testing tools and Babel and Jest and all these things all the time? Are they, you know, having to dive in and upgrade, you know, the versions and like lose a week of productivity because they keep doing that? Are they complaining about the compile cycle? So you want to hear those out and don't disregard them as just engineers doing their usual complaining. And then you need to also think, not everyone could be a good developer tools engineer. Not everyone is interested in it. Just like not everyone can be a good product engineer, right? Some people have product engineers have good product sensibilities and they kind of know what users want and they can sort of think through that. Same thing with develop tools engineer. They're usually like very passionate about tools. They're usually filled with ideas on how things could get better. So if you have, I would say don't kind of pre-allocate that. So at Facebook, we had this group called product infrastructure. And so product infrastructure, I think there's been a lot of reorging at Facebook. So I don't know if it's still there. But when I was there, that team was kind of small. And they had this rule that you can't join that team unless you've spent at least a year on product. And so that was a very good rule, very good heuristic, because if you feel the pain and then you go interview with them and say, like, you know, I know what's it like to build applications at Facebook and I think I can make it much better. And here are my ideas. So you're going to have these developer tool people already are filled with ideas. You want to pay attention not to like hire architecture astronauts, you know, people that add complexity for no reason. And there's a lot of people like that in the dev tools space, right? You just want to toy with things, and that's not the right way to go at it. So I'd say allocate from within someone who's already vocal, already doing the job. You're going to see someone who's already kind of trying to do the job. Other people rely on them for that and maybe give them more and more time to do that. And if you're seeing kind of returns on investment, other engineers are being productive, then maybe you put in more into that team. So I would say approach it kind of empirically, organically, and with time.
What's a belief about leading software teams that younger Amjad would probably disagree with?
That managers are a good thing. So, you know, like every sort of hacker had this sort of anarchist view of management, that like managers are sort of waste of oxygen in organizations. but a lot of engineers, by the way, think that way. And you've had sort of colossal failures where companies try to adopt that on a massive level.
So what changed your mind about the value of managers?
Being at startups with no managers and having no one to talk to and being unhappy without being able to influence decisions, seeing the chaos and the sort of click behavior that emerges with no managers, people start bonding over the bad things, right? They start gossiping. You start seeing all the, you know, bad things about groups of people start to emerge. When you have good managers, and so that's one. But really, what really convinced me was having a good manager. A good manager at Facebook, Tom Aquino, who managed the React team actually at Facebook, was one of my first really good managers. And I felt much more productive talking to him. And I felt the relationship changed. Instead of this authoritarian view of management, it was more like, this is a person that's helping me be productive, that's helping me solve problems, that's helping me communicate better, that's coaching me through rough periods. And this view of management made it less about authority, less about being the boss, and more about efficiency and productivity, increasing communication flow, you know, breaking down silos, and for leaders to sort of make sure they have a good sense and good sort of like heartbeat on the organization.
What are some things you've borrowed from Tom?
Being non-compromising with performance, at the same time being kind. Like you want to push people to do the best job that they can do, but not losing the kindness and not losing the sort of the human connection and the understanding. I think this was probably like one of my biggest takeaways.
Amjad, if you had a magic wand and you could spread one idea out there that would improve hiring, one idea out into the zeitgeist that developer managers could know that would make hiring better for everyone, what would that idea be?
I think people should pay more attention to talent discovery rather than talent acquisition. We think of recruiting as we want to go, especially for startups, and I think more my advice is going to be more, you know, that's where most of my experience is, but it also applies on bigger companies. I think, you know, we tend to kind of be stuck in our own bubble, and we look at people's resumes and we want to see all these big names and big universities. Talent is everywhere, opportunity is not. So I would say the upside of discovering talent is huge. At Replit, our first hire was 19 years old. He had dropped out of college and he wanted to break into San Francisco tech scene. And he went to Hack Reactor, and Hack Reactor was one of our users. So we found them through them, one of our customers. And we hired him, and he's now indispensable. He's one of the biggest drivers of invention in the company. He's creating a lot of the new products and ideas. And I did that multiple times. And when you do it, when you discover talent, usually you can also coach them in a way that really, that you think would get them to have the most impact on your company and on the world. I've done that before at Facebook as well. Discovered talent, found people, younger people from different parts of the world, and recruited them to our team. And, you know, Facebook being a little bit more forgiving, not having a lot of credentials and being more merit-based helped. Not every part of the organization is like that, but definitely on the infrastructure side. So I've had good luck with this before, and I think it's not only good for the companies, it's also good for economic growth. It's good for sort of fairness and giving more people a chance. I had a tweet this morning about how the startup scene in Silicon Valley is one of the most open to outsiders. You know, a big part of what makes it open is that a lot of startups know that they're in the business of talent discovery. So let's try to grow people. And believe me, it's going to be worth your time. I want to get better at discovering people as well. I don't know how we do it. Maybe Replit is a good vehicle for that as well. But I feel like there's so much that we could do in terms of making hiring better and faster if we just didn't focus on the top of the top, right?
What are some, so if I'm an engineering manager and I believe that there's talent is evenly distributed, but opportunity is not, what are some steps I could take to help my organization get better at discovering talent rather than just looking for credentials on resumes?
I would say you're going to have a lot of inbound, you're going to see a lot of resumes that you might disregard, that just take a moment to not disregard it. If you don't see any of the big names in the resume, still give them a chance. Look at their GitHub, look at their creations. If they're an engineer, probably on GitHub, different places, increasingly Replit. Look at what they've made. Don't immediately jump to the, you know, prestige. Like, prestige doesn't matter anymore. Like, the big schools don't matter anymore. You know, I think, you know, we're seeing a big change now. You know, Lambda School has been in the news a lot. Are you familiar with it?
I'm a big fan of Lambda School.
Yeah, so Lambda School, 9 months coding bootcamp, no fees, just an income sharing agreement. You kind of kick back after you get your first job. And the stories that's coming out of that of people kind of changing their lives, going from working as bodyguards in some cases to making $200,000 as software engineers. And so that's one way you can sort of partner with these organizations. Don't disregard resumes. Maybe have some kind of sponsor some outreach group, sponsor some, you know, diversity hackathons, sponsor some, you know, different different. There's a lot of initiatives now that you can like go look for people there, and just being open. I think you're gonna start seeing more and more people. I think maybe also remote friendly helps a lot. Like if you're some people can't move. I feel like a slightly like a hypocrite saying that because we haven't been so remote friendly, but we're starting now to sort of become that. We're hiring our first remote person and hopefully get better at that. But the world is an increasingly online world, increasingly internet world. And so this is one of the steps that you can sort of discover and acquire talents that might not be discovered otherwise.
It's a big world. There's lots of talented folks out there, and not all in San Francisco.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Replit, Amjad has built a world-class engineering team by finding under-recognized talent, including a 19-year-old college dropout. With a traditional resume screen, this talented engineer would have been ignored. Personally, I don't think that's very fair, and it's not very good for our teams. That's why I started Woven. Woven owns the top of your hiring funnel, from resume and application review through vetting on technical aptitude, collaboration, and problem-solving skills. When a candidate lands on your calendar, you know they can build software, so you have more success and faster hiring. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your team, check us out at woventeams.com.
So let's move on to the rapid fire round. So I'll ask a question and you give your quick response. What's the most impressive thing a candidate has done in an interview that helps you realize they were a good fit?
They are able to dive as deep as I can ask them about the problems that they're solving. Just like no limit. I usually ask questions about the stuff that they've made. And so I'm going to keep asking you to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And some people get annoyed and angry in some cases. But if you're able to like kind of do that, then I know that you've thought of this problem ins and outs and you've solved it by yourself. And this is really impressive to me.
What's a mistake you've seen an engineering candidate make during an interview that they maybe didn't realize they were making?
I think ego sometimes gets in the way. Like, you know, of course, as a hiring manager, as an interviewer, you want to be kind and sensitive, but sometimes you're just trying to, it goes back to the previous question. You're just trying to like get at the sort of depth of the problem. And some people get annoyed by that, feel slighted. Maybe you think they don't know, maybe, you know, things like that. I've seen people's egos have turned up in these situations. And I think a lot of otherwise good candidates would probably be disregarded because they've had some kind of ego problem.
Which matters more when hiring, hard technical skills or soft catalytic skills?
I think depending on the person. I think 10x engineers, I believe in them, by the way, which might be a controversial thing, but I think they come in different flavors. I think there are 10x engineers that are connectors that bring different parts of the company together. There are 10x engineers that are like purely individual contributors that go in and hack and create new systems. There are 10x engineers that are able to discover new products and features that they want to build. Like maybe they're like really good at ideas. There are like so many flavors of really good engineers. And so sort of finding your niche is worthwhile. So keep looking for that niche. Where's your superpower? Keep asking yourself, what is my superpower?
What does a 6-star culture fit look like at Replit?
Inventive. They would continue to impress us. Like we have a culture of impressing each other, which I think is really awesome. Like, you know, someone makes something on the weekend or someday and we'll just like the next day they'll show it to us and we're all mind blown. And their respect has gone through the roof in the organization. They have a lot more clout now and other people want to top that. And so you have this like nice competitive edge. So we want people, yes, we want people that are competitive, inventive, but also collaborative and kind and inclusive. And, you know, that's hard to come by because sometimes people who are, you know, in the weeds might lack some of the collaborative aspects of this. And this goes back to discovering talents and growing talent. this is an area that I'm willing to work with people. I'm describing the six star person. I don't think we can find people like that. But if we hit a few of those properties, then I'm willing to work on the other properties with them. I'm willing to kind of grow them into that person.
My guest today has been Amjad Massad. Amjad, thank you for being on Scaling Software Teams.
Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Amjad for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from my chat with Amjad. 1, never let perfect be the enemy of the good. I personally struggle with not shipping things because of misguided perfectionism. Amjad analyzed himself and decided that the root is fear and ego. As Reid Hoffman said, if you're not embarrassed by the first version of your product, you've launched too late. Amjad believes the best way to fight it is by shipping a lot as a form of exposure therapy. 2, investing in developer tools has an outsized effect on productivity. Software development is one of the highest leverage, most expensive jobs on the planet, and yet we're pretty bad at providing developers with the tools they need to be successful. At Facebook, the product tools team only recruited from engineers who had been product engineers for at least a year. That ensured that they knew which frictions really impacted product delivery. 3, talent is evenly distributed, but opportunity is not. At Replit, Amjad's first hire was 19 years old, and he's become indispensable. We've heard this story over and over again. Hiring can be really hard, but getting it right is essential to both economic growth and fairness in the workplace. Thank you so much again for Amjad for sharing his perspective with us today. Now, I want your perspective. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Thanks so much for listening and subscribing, and I'll talk to you next week.